to be able to introduce this fabulous expert on Russia, its leaders, and especially Vladimir Putin. In fact, she just had a book out on Vladimir Putin. It just came out last month. She is a well-known expert on these issues, a lecturer, an author, and one of the heads of the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. But the question is, how did a little girl who grew up in a mining town in the north of England, where it rains 300 days of the year, get from there to here? It's kind of a cute story. She told me about it. It goes back to the year 1988, when this young girl, with local support and everything, became a British exchange student in Russia. 1988 was also the year of the Reagan-Gorbachev summit meeting in Moscow, and she was assigned to be an intern and a stringer, if you will, for NBC News at that summit where they were covering, of course, the event. But there was a problem. Nobody at NBC News could understand her because of the heavy Northern England accent at the time. So they didn't know what to do with her. So they gave her a menial job. Her job, get this, was to spray Tom Brokaw's hair. Okay. Then they asked her to go into the coffee room and make coffee for Maria Shriver. There was another problem. She had never had coffee. Never knew how to make coffee. They drink tea in England. So she, according to her, made a complete mess of the coffee room, fumbling around. At that point, a professor walked in, and he saw the dilemma. He helped her clean up the place, got to talking about education. He was smart. He could understand her. And he told her how she could apply for a scholarship in the United States. She followed his instructions to the letter. She snagged a scholarship to Harvard, went on from there to become a Russian expert that we will have with us today. Now, just think about it. If she had known how to make coffee, she might not be here. So please pour yourself a cup of coffee and give a warm Forum Club welcome to Dr. Fiona Hill.
Well, I wanted to thank Kana very much for that. And, you know, this is actually a true story. And the professor was Bob Legvold, who some of you may know of, a very distinguished professor from Columbia who had been an old friend of Tom Brokaw from back in the day in the Dakotas. They'd gone to school together. And he wrote a book just recently about return to Cold War, all very prescient. And I just wanted to say to my fellow speakers earlier that you never know where life might take you from some of these chance encounters and some of the opportunities that are given to you. And I'm really impressed with you and very inspired by what you had to say and the fact that you actually have taken the courageous step to enroll in these programs. Because I, as Kana is suggesting, am also a product of the signed of mentorship programs and also the public-private philanthropy that you're benefiting from now. One of my first fellowships to learn to study Russian came from the local Rotary Club, Rotary Club International. So you're already on the track. You don't have to start studying Russian, though, you know, but I think, you know, what you're doing now is really fantastic. And I just commend everybody else here, too, for setting up that program. I'd like to use that also to start thinking about Vladimir Putin. Because today the president-elect is having his classified briefing on Mr. Putin, Russia, and all of the events that have led up to what has been actually a confrontation on the scale of the kind of confrontations that we had back in the 1980s. A confrontation that in the 1980s, when we had the war scare, where we really were on the brink of a nuclear confrontation. Now that we've had the declassification of all of the documents, in fact, there's a huge book now being produced of all of the Reagan-Gorbachev cemetery. Probably Kana is featured in it, if you can make it through the literally 6,000 pages of this book that has just been released by the U.S. State Department. It shows just what a precarious situation it was from 1981 to about 1984 in particular. The Soviet Union was convinced that the U.S. was contemplating a first nuclear strike. This is the height of Star Wars. And it really took two men with a very different perspective on things, Mikhail Gorbachev on the one hand and Ronald Reagan on the other, but who had a real sense of leadership And also a real personal warmth and willingness to think about things differently, to walk us back from that brink. And Kana was telling me some of her stories both last night and at lunch, from which I've really benefited. But we're really in that time again. Because we came on the eve of our presidential election, on the brink of another huge confrontation with Russia, which has taken on different dimensions, but missile defense, nuclear weapons are all back on the table again. People in Moscow, in the Russian military, many of whom might have started off in the Soviet military, are talking again about the prospects of using nuclear weapons, this time that they might launch a first strike in the advent of a local or regional conflict, turning into a major conflict with NATO or with the United States. It's a kind of loose talk about the use of nuclear weapons that we haven't basically heard of in 30 years. And we know that the president-elect, like presidents before him, is thinking long and hard about how can he put this relationship on a different trajectory. So here we are. So what kind of person will he be dealing with on the other side of this issue? This is who will President-elect Donald Trump be dealing with in the person of Vladimir Putin? Well, he's certainly not Mikhail Gorbachev. That's for sure. So he's going to be a much more difficult person to deal with. Kana was telling about a meeting that she had personally with Gorbachev, who just had a very warm and open personality, beautiful blue eyes, you know, kind of a very nice way and demeanor of talking to people. Gorbachev came from a rather humble background, but had risen up through the Communist Party. He came from the agricultural region of Stavropol, a farming region in Russia, and he never forgot his origins. Vladimir Putin is something of an outsider to the political system, but he's from, you know, what some countries they call the deep state. He rose up also from very humble origins, but not through the Communist Party, through political mechanisms, but through the back, very dark corridors of the KGB. And he decided when he was a young schoolboy back in what was then Leningrad in St. Petersburg, that he wanted to join the KGB at the time because of the swashbuckling idea of, you know, daring do and, you know, the kind of stories of what a fighting Nazi Germany during World War II. He learned German, actually, very interestingly, because he saw reconciliation with Germany as important, but also because Germany was then the divided country of East and West Germany, an opportunity to perhaps be a spy in East Germany. Like the hero of a television series that Putin and other people of his generation had watched about an intelligence officer who went behind enemy lines in Nazi Germany, passed off as a German, and helped sort of bring down the Third Reich, a guy named Stirlitz. It's a sort of a famous series there. So Putin had all these ideas about what he wanted to be, but he didn't take the conventional path through politics. His family were actually not members of the Communist Party. So one thing to bear in mind about Putin, first and foremost, is he was not a communist. And when he talks about the catastrophe of the collapse of the Soviet Union, which everybody mentions as one of his great quotes from several years ago, he talks about the collapse of the Soviet Union 25 years ago this year, or last year rather, in December, as being one of the great tragedies, the great catastrophes of the 20th century, he was thinking more about the collapse of the state, of what was the Russian state and the Russian Empire, you know, over many iterations. This year is actually the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, which brought about the first collapse of the state, so the Russian Empire. And Putin has mentioned many times that this is a state that has gone through multiple forms, but has always been there in some shape and form. And he sees himself as a servant of that state, not of a party, not of a particular institution. And the KGB had the emblem, the motto of being the sword and the shield of the state. It wasn't part of the Communist Party edifice. So Putin sees himself, in many respects, as someone who has stepped forward to give service to the state and to stop the state from collapsing again. So that, and he genuinely believes this. This is not just some... I think the demonization of Putin is always very dangerous because there are always things that you can see that a person deeply believes in at a certain period. And Putin sees himself, you know, whether, you know, we may always buy the way that he articulates this, as someone who is deeply invested in serving the state and in keeping the state together. And part of the idea of the collapse of the Soviet Union was that it lost its place in the world. In some autobiographical interviews that Putin gave very early on in his tenure as the head of Russia back in 2000, he talked about the great loss of Russia's position in Europe with the collapse of the Soviet Union. He was at the time serving in Dresden in East Germany in the KGB, so he fulfilled one of those early dreams. He managed to pass himself off as German or as the translator for the Soviet representation in Dresden and blend in, you know, quite well with the population and things there. Took great pride in his German. His German is actually extremely good. And he really felt that basically the Soviet Union had disappeared without a bang and without a whisper and had just forfeited its whole position. So if you put that in the background and you think about this kind of mentality of a young person wanting to serve the state and to push it forward, one of the leitmotifs and the themes of his career has been about restoring the state, putting it back on top. Now, this career in the KGB means that his ways of doing this are, let's just say, perhaps not the ways that we would possibly choose for ourselves if we were in a different position. These are not the ways of a politician or of a political figure. They're certainly not going to be the ways of Reagan and Gorbachev. Because there are certain things about being a KGB operative that, as Putin has often said, are very useful for being a politician. If you think about politics as big machine ward politics, you know, think Chicago and, you know, certain eras or, well, actually lots of other different, political settings. You know, there's a real kind of cutthroat element to this. So Putin talks often about two skills that he learned in the KGB that he applies in his political positions and that he thinks are his most useful skills. He's often talked about himself as being an expert in human relations, obviously not in the HR department of, you know, kind of a big corporation. But his two skills are working with people and working with information. Now, what he means by working with people is probably all the things that you're thinking about right now. How do you work to get people to do the things that you want them to do or to stop them from doing the kinds of things that you don't want them to do? Now, that can be done in all kinds of different ways. And Putin was trained to be a recruiter, somebody who would go out and target individuals for trying to recruit them as an asset for the KGB. You know, getting them to, you know, feel that they were going to do the things that he wanted them to do. He was their connection to the KGB. And you could recruit people in various different ways. You could exploit their vulnerabilities and the mistakes that they'd made. Look for some of the bad things that they've done. Blackmail, essentially, and, you know, manipulating them. Or you could play to their better nature. You know, find a connection with them. You see that, you might remember early on the meeting between George W. Bush and Putin in Slovenia. The famous, you know, I looked into his eyes and I saw his soul that, you know, George W. got raked over the coals for multiple times about. That was Putin's effort at being a recruiter, of, you know, gazing into, he was actually gazing into the eyes of George W. Bush and trying to figure out how can I make a connection here. And he actually picked religion and Christianity. Putin told Bush a story about how he had been baptized as a young person secretly by his grandparents. You know, again, this comes in the idea of not being part of the Communist Party. And that he'd had a hidden faith throughout the whole period. And that he actually believed, in many respects, that the church still had a great role to play in the state. Now, he might have a different idea of that, and we can maybe talk about that a little later. But he tried to make this connection with the president, knowing that the president had returned to religion, you know, after a period of, you know, personal and other difficulties, and then told him the story about how he had been in a fire at his country home, his dacha. The whole place had burned down, but that he miraculously found the cross that his grandmother had given him to wear under his clothes in the embers of the fire. A very compelling story. We don't know if it's true or not, because the only person who told this story was Vladimir Putin to George W. Bush. And I can promise you that President Bush knew he was being, you know, told a story, but Bush himself was wanting to improve the relationship with Putin. And so he was looking, as Margaret Thatcher had done, you know, famously said about Mikhail Gorbachev, to looking for someone he could do business with. So Bush was himself trying to do a little bit of, you know, that kind of reversal of, you know, I think this is a man I can do business with, and they'd had this, you know, connection made here. So that's the positive side of making a connection. The rather negative side of this, which is also something that the KGB specialised in terms of, you know, making people think about how to do things differently, was giving them the dark warnings of what could happen to them. It always helped to have the Lubyanka, the famous KGB jail, just sitting there, and all the tales of what could happen in the bowels of the Lubyanka if you've gone on the wrong side of something. As a clear message there that if things go badly wrong, things could really go badly wrong for you here. So perhaps you might want to, you know, rethink things that you're thinking about. Now, the other part of this way that Putin approaches things is working, as I said, with information. Now, working with information in these last several months has brought on some different connotations. Cybersecurity, hacking, you know, how you distribute information, how information is used. And there's been a very interesting observation by Putin that you might recall when he's been accused, you know, directly of being involved in the various hacking activities that we've been hearing about so much over the last several weeks. And he said, well, who cares about the source of the information? It's the information that's most important and what that tells you. So Putin is a master of thinking about information, everything from historical narratives to political information to personal information, just information about larger social dynamics, and how you use that information is really important as a tool, which is why we've seen over the last 16 years of Putin being either prime minister or president of Russia that he's paid so much attention to public relations, to political performances, to highly orchestrated meetings with people, to press conferences, and basically to the use of the media. Putin, every year, has a series of big annual press conferences to deal with questions, because it's not about the questions themselves, it's how you answer them. I've taken part in several of these expert meetings with Putin where you get to sit at a table with him. I've actually sat next to him twice. And he doesn't really care about so much about who you are, it's about the question you ask, what that tells you about him. He never asks any questions, by the way, because his belief is that if you ask a question, it tells something about you, because most people will ask a question that is something personal to them or something that they want to show about themselves. Coming from the Washington think tank world, you know that people are not asking questions. They're not really trying to show what they know already, because the question is usually, well, don't you think, you know, at the end of it, rather than, is this, you know, an actual question? And Putin is always, if you've got the information at your fingertips, you know something roughly about the person, then how you answer is how you, you know, persuade them, or how you, you know, you kind of push back on an issue and you establish your position on something, or how you can move forward your agenda. The other thing that Putin does, which is going to be very relevant for thinking into the future, is he personalizes everything, every interaction. This is partly the nature of Russian politics, which goes right back to the eras of the Tsars, where you had a very personalized political system, initially centered around the Tsar himself and his inner court of aristocrats or immediate relatives. And also in the Soviet period, where we had the general secretaries of the Soviet Union and the Politburo around them as a kind of formalized court, and then the mass of the party outside. But everything was always happening inside of the Kremlin walls or inside the Politburo, hence why we were so obsessed with Kremlinology or court politics. And so Putin, and the fact that he has a very tight inner circle around him, very small group of mostly men, but not exclusively, mostly men, that he is known throughout his entire life and also professional career, and since he was in Moscow. Some of the people who were close to Putin trained with him as judo in his teenage years. He's extremely accomplished at judo. And many of the people that you see around him trained with him. He thinks it gave him discipline and certainly kind of helped to create a sense of cohesion in the people around him that he knows from that period. They've also served in the KGB, or they've had positions with him since he's been at the head of state. This inner circle and this very closed, opaque way of doing business is very typical for Russian politics.
So the personalized nature of this, Putin is the one person that we see, the one decisive voice, the one person who speaks and you know that they have some authority. Everything else is a bit of information, disinformation, misinformation. You can never be sure unless Putin says something that it really has measure and clout is very important. And he tends to then take that into his interactions with domestic political figures. It's always one-on-one. There's always these what seem on the outside incredibly boring, really kind of mind-numbing sets of televised encounters between Vladimir Putin and leading political figures, business people, who will, you know, kind of call into his office and have a one-on-one meeting with, and the first part of it will be televised, and then also with foreign leaders. Putin likes to show up at events where he's going to be just one of a few of the guys in a room. He doesn't want to be, you know, one in a crowd. He doesn't like the, you know, the really big meetings like the G20 and others, unless he can be, you know, really there, or the United Nations, in the spotlight. And he always wants to meet with the leader of the particular country. And this is where we've had ourselves in a major problem over the last several years. Obama and Putin never got any chemistry at all. You know, maybe one might think, well, that's probably actually a good thing given, you know, the nature of Putin. But it's also a very bad thing, because in the Russian system, the only person who really counts as your interlocutor is the guy on the top. And if there's no semblance of personal chemistry and there are no one-on-one meetings, then there is no business of state being done. And, you know, we got to such a problem in the last year that the only interconnection and channel with the very top of Russia was Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov. And we can be sure that in both cases, neither of them were the decision makers or the, you know, appropriate channel for really communicating what's going on behind the scenes. So Putin, when you look very closely, what he does, he goes out there and he meets with the leader. He's just recently been in Japan, meeting with Prime Minister Abe. He has been meeting and patching up relations with President Erdogan of Turkey. All of these meetings are deeply significant because Putin believes, on the basis of his KGB training, that he is the guy who has to basically recruit these world leaders, you know, recruit them to his way of thinking, to be able to use the information to have these personal interactions with them, to be able to find, you know, basically a way forward. And the way that he treated Erdogan of Turkey, and I'll use this as kind of closing and then to get to your questions, I think is really instructive of some of the things that we should be thinking about when we look forward to what will, you know, eventually be the first encounter between our president-elect and President Putin, about the way that Putin approaches issues. So Erdogan and Putin, as we know actually from Putin revealing most of this information, had had a number of secret talks about Syria. Clearly, making a deal about the Kurds in Syria, who have been, for the United States, something of an ally in our efforts to change the course of events on the ground in Syria during the civil war. For Erdogan of Turkey, this has been an incredible crisis in his relationship with the United States, because the one thing that Erdogan fears most, apart from losing his own personal position, is the splintering of Turkey and the establishment of an independent Kurdish state that would, you know, basically eventually or could potentially join up with Kurds in Syria and Kurds in Iraq and you know, the region of Kurdistan there. Putin and Erdogan clearly had a series of meetings about this to try to find a modus vivendi in Syria where they actually have quite opposing views, and Erdogan was quite keen on getting rid of Assad as well. Then there was the shooting down by the Turkish Air Force of a Russian plane that made an incursion, you remember, a year ago, across the border into Turkey. This was clearly ordered by the Air Force, and, you know, couldn't have happened without some order by Erdogan, you know, to allow this to happen. And it was in response to the bombing by Russian aircraft and Assad's forces of villages of ethnic Turks, Turkmen, in northern Syria. And Erdogan was under a lot of pressure from his own politics and people around him to do something about this. The plane comes down and Putin comes out relentlessly, relentless hardball after Erdogan personally. He makes a distinction saying this isn't a problem between me and the people of Turkey or the Russian people of Turkey, and he's going to cut off all ties, diplomatic ties. He puts sanctions on Turkey, blocks Turkish business at a very delicate time for Turkey. but he goes right after Erdogan personally. He reveals that they had this deal. And he said, you know, we had a deal about Kurds, not about Turkmen. Nobody mentioned this. He said this was a stab in the back. And then he starts laying out all of the things that Erdogan is having basically reporters arrested for in Turkey. Stories about corruption in Erdogan's personal entourage and his family. The fact that Erdogan has been letting fighters go through Turkish territory to join ISIS and to fight in Syria. Stories about Erdogan's son and involvement in illicit oil trade in Syria and elsewhere. All kinds of things that investigative journalists in Turkey have been reporting about, but have been, you know, getting arrested and ending up in jail about. Just unrelenting in terms of his attacks on Erdogan. And eventually, Erdogan has to apologize, because Erdogan has the misfortune of having a coup in Turkey in July, as you might recall. His domestic situation becomes incredibly perilous. And Putin's relentless attacks on him personally make his situation even more difficult internally. And the sanctions that Russia's imposed on the Turkish economy lead to a 40% decline in the tourism industry and in the agricultural sector at a time when the Turkish economy is faltering and is already the Turkish lira is in free fall. And I was in Turkey in October. At the very day that Putin came back after Erdogan had apologized to sort of patch up the relationship, and the scenes on Turkish television of Erdogan and Putin walking back hand in hand into a room with the first meeting that they've had since this period. And one of the senior Turks I was meeting with said, "We understood the way that Putin works with people. We understood what the enmity of Putin, the personal enmity of Putin, could be like. We realize this is not real friendship. But we had no alternative, given the circumstances." So this is an illustration of the points that I was trying to make here. You know, Vladimir Putin can be one tough cookie. He's put together his own personal views and personal feelings, his perspective on the Russian state, and then the training that he's been given has helped him rise up through these back corridors, you know, very quietly, very silently, until he gets himself into a position, you know, where he basically makes connections with the right people to be in the right place at the right time. And he's applied all of this training into not just his own domestic politics, because he treats people in the Russian arena in a very similar way, but also in international politics. So this is not Mikhail Gorbachev. Nonetheless, it doesn't mean to say that we can't find a way of working with him and moving this relationship onto a different track. Anyway, thank you, and Kana, I'm ready to go to questions.
That was great. We have so many questions. Let me get to them. I'll probably try to combine a few of them. Of course, a lot of people want to know, what are your views on the Russian hacking of the U.S. political process? Do you think Putin orchestrated it? Do you think Putin and Trump made a deal for Putin to disrupt the election?
Well, that last question, of course, is extraordinarily explosive, and the answer to that is no, I do not believe that's the case. But the overall question about the hacking, I do believe that this was a state-orchestrated hack. Now, does this mean that Putin gave the direct order? I think it's a very high bar to prove that, but I'm presuming that we're going to be hearing shortly some fashion, because we won't get the whole classified information about this, nor should we, of the evidence and information that the intelligence community has amassed on this from across all of the 17 intelligence agencies that have led to this judgment that they have made. They have pretty much said that they're 90% sure. Now, having spent 3.5 years on loan to the National Intelligence Council by Brookings from 2006 to 2009, and having actually presided over a number of these assessments, I know that that's a pretty high bar, and that they wouldn't be saying this unless they were pretty sure. The point is that they bring in intelligence from, as I said, 17 different agencies, all kinds of sources. Will it be, kind of a high enough proof to be ironclad that, you can then, present to everybody? I think is going to be quite difficult, because, again, we won't be and we should not be seeing all of the classified information. I think that the appropriate place to be really assessing all of this is actually in Congress and in the Senate. So we're actually on the right track in terms of doing this, because it's their responsibility to have the oversight of the intelligence. We seem to be asking all of those very hard questions. But I have to tell you that I've had my own personal experiences of this hacking. And you can be pretty sure that the way that this kind of works is that someone at the top in the Kremlin, Putin or the people around him in the national security team, will want to know everything that they possibly can about the US political system and its leaders. Well, why would they not? We want to do the same thing. And we have been doing this, you know, trying to figure out whatever we can from all sources about what information can we find out about the leadership. And because of the nature of Putin that I've just explained to you, as somebody who wants to personally know this, so they can personally tell his own interactions with his people, he wants to know everything he can from whatever sources he can get. So that whoever it is then is tasked with going out and getting that information can then decide how they're going to do it. That's the way that these things work. So whether he directly said, go out there and, you know, hack X or Y, I think that might be debatable. But did he go and say, go forth and get all of this information? You can be pretty much sure he did. And then there's an awful lot of people are going out there, well, how can I get in that information and who can I use to get that information? And that's the realm that we're in, where it's going to be very difficult for all of us to have that ironclad information. That's why the FBI were probably quite a lot more reluctant, you know, to basically step forward in such a forward-leaning way, and so they can dot their I's and cross their T's, because they might then have to engage in some kind of criminal prosecution. But as I mentioned to Carnaby, if I've been personally hacked, I was hacked when I left the National Intelligence Council. I had my contact database and all of my schedule taken. And it wasn't for me per se, but it was to get access to all of the information and meetings that I'd clearly had as a National Intelligence Officer, and also to get hold of all of the mobile phones and all of the other kind of information that I had for people. You know, I work at an institution, Brookings, where Strobe Talbot, you know, is clearly a close personal friend of the Clintons, or people who have come in from other administrations, where if you get one set of people's mobile phones, you can be sure that you can get others or email addresses. I got rid of my personal email after that, and I've gone through 5 iPhones. And every time I come to a highly publicized public event on speaking about Russia and Putin, it can be internationally, Germany, London, my iPhone has died. And I have talked to so many people in the cyber world and others where they have basically said, that is the MO, that is the pattern. I had the FBI go, you know, off with my hard drive from my computer the first time it happened. You can be sure that the Russians are hacking. How, you know, the whole order of that has been given is probably, you know, going to be a very high bar, unless you've got the written order or, you know, some kind of record of Vladimir Putin, who also doesn't have an email, probably does not have a mobile phone. And we've heard very recently, just, you know, from my own personal interactions with people, that all of the people in the inner circle now no longer have mobile phones in Russia, and that they started, you know, getting rid of their mobile phones quite a while back. So, you know, just as another piece of information for you.
So we're back to Post-its.
Yes, exactly. Edible Post-its.
There were several questions about Putin's moves, not just with respect to the United States, but, for example, recent articles have stated that the Crimeans are now happier as part of Russia than as part of Ukraine. What are your thoughts about Putin's game plan for Ukraine?
Ukraine is really, I think, one of the trickiest issues that we have to deal with along many, but in terms of our interactions with Russia. The annexation of Crimea by Putin actually should not have been a surprise to anyone, even, you know, amateur students of Russian history, you know, sitting around, you know, reading about Russia's efforts to always get itself a position on the Black Sea. Crimea is the home of the Black Sea Fleet. It was taken by Catherine the Great in wars with the Ottoman Empire back in the late 18th century, 1740s to 1770s. It's kind of become part of the national myth and narrative about Russia and the Russian Empire. In the early 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were many efforts to put pressure on Ukraine to not only give Russia effective control of Crimea as the base of the Black Sea Fleet, but also to potentially to hand Crimea back. So we've been there many times before. Boris Yeltsin, that was just not the kind of thing that he was especially interested in pursuing, and also he didn't really have the capacity for doing that. In 2008, when Russia launched the intervention in Georgia, when Georgia had been, along with Ukraine, given an open door to joining NATO at some point. I have to say that we, among the Russian analysts, were pretty convinced that something would happen also in Crimea. Perhaps not the full annexation of the peninsula, but there would be incidents in Sevastopol or in some of the other, you know, major bases where, you know, there could be some kind of provocation, and the Russians would definitely try to take control of those ports. Because the last thing that they would ever want was, you know, the Ukrainian Navy, you know, taking those over, ending their lease of this critical strategic port infrastructure, and potentially having exercises with NATO Navy somewhere down the line. I mean, this for them was always a major flashpoint. It didn't happen in 2008 because the Ukrainian president at that time, Yushchenko, was no real friend of the Russians, backed off from the idea of NATO membership because it wasn't popular in Ukraine overall. There was just not really the desire to be part of NATO because the Ukrainians still really saw themselves as very closely affiliated with Russia. So the sort of steam was taken out of the issue after another kind of period of confrontation. So when you have the revolution in Ukraine in the end of 2013, and basically Yanukovych, the Ukrainian president who's made all kinds of backdoor deals with Putin and the Russians, gets toppled, it wasn't a big stretch to think that the Russians might move in and do something there in Crimea, because again, if Ukraine is going to join EU, you know, then eventually they'll probably join NATO. You've still got the open door, as in from 2008. And the last thing you want to see is any prospect that that's going to happen and that you're going to lose the lease on that base. Putin, another issue that I could have mentioned, is he missed a preemption. If he sees a threat, he gets ahead of that threat and he goes after it right away. And he's also a planner. He may not be a great, you know, Kissinger strategist, but he's got plans, contingency plans. If one thing goes wrong, you think of another thing. You think of another thing always to protect your interests and to get to your goals. Crimea was something that Putin had started to make very personal. He was making a lot of personal speeches, putting himself in the history of Ukraine and Crimea in the run-up to all of these events, and stressing how important this has been for the image of Russia as a state and an empire. And for the Soviet period, Sevastopol was one of the hero cities of World War II. So Crimea, that was just really fairly obvious that they were going to go in and do something and clearly want to make it so there's no argument. Annex, you know, make it part of the Russian Federation. In terms of Ukraine itself, Putin wants to have leverage. He doesn't necessarily want to resolve this conflict. And this is going to be a dilemma for us because we're going to be trying to think about how can we slice and dice Ukraine? How can we come up with a new European security arrangement that, you know, maybe neutralizes Ukraine, make sure it doesn't go into NATO anymore, go back to the Cold War where Austria was neutralized and Finland. I mean, can we use these principles again? Putin wants to make sure that Ukraine's going nowhere. So it's actually more in his interest to have this uncertainty about the future of Ukraine and a simmering conflict that you can turn up and turn down, you know, as you might need to. And I think that's going to be our major challenge, that Crimea is one thing, but Ukraine and the civil war that has been sparked off and the insurgency in Ukraine is going to be fiendishly difficult for us to find a resolution to.
Can you tell us about Putin's hidden wealth?
Well, one of the big issues about being president of Russia is you have at your disposal fabulous assets and wealth in any case. And when Vladimir Putin first moved down to Moscow in 1996, he'd been a deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, and his boss, Anatoly Sobchak, had also been his law professor back in the day in Leningrad University. They were very closely connected together. When he lost his re-election as mayor, Putin was desperate for a job. And a couple of his former colleagues in the St. Petersburg mayor office had already gone to Moscow and worked in the Yeltsin team. And they brought Putin over to Moscow, and he was in charge of the Kremlin Property Agency, among one of his many other positions. The Kremlin has more property than you can possibly imagine. Basically, they have dachas, they have you know, basically holiday homes in Florida, possibly, also. I don't know, who knows. They have, you know, planes at their lease. They have all kinds of government building, old palaces. I mean, basically, it's the patrimony of the country. And Putin was in charge of that. It was like doling out perks and favors. So Putin knows where everything is, you know, basically. And as president, he's got basically all of that at his command. There's also an awful lot of stories Putin has assets in his name. People who were close to him, I've mentioned some of the people who he trained with at judo as a teenager who have now become billionaires. You know, some of them might be your Florida neighbors, elsewhere. They've often got, homes here as well as other places. Although they've started to, since we've gotten to this confrontational posture, move back home a lot of their assets. But there's an idea then that, he can call upon those assets at some point, that they're being kind of kept in escrow, in a blind trust of some description for him. I think, needless to say, Putin is very well provided for. And there is also, he gets a lot of gifts, and you get to keep your gifts as a Russian president. And I also think that he likes to give the impression that he might be the richest man in Russia, because there's power in that. It's like the Russian Tsars. They were not the richest monarchs in Europe, but they liked everyone to think that they were. And Yeltsin's problem back in the 1990s was that he was poor as a church mouse, almost. Basically, he had to make deals with the oligarchs to get re-elected in the 1990s. The country was broke, the presidency was broke, and there wasn't much, basically to enrich yourself in. Putin wants to be the guy who is the head of a solvent, prosperous country, at least on the outskirts, on the outsides of this. And if he sits at a table, he wants to be the richest guy at that table, not beholden to somebody else who might have influence over him.
Okay, we don't have too much time here. Just last two questions. The first one here would take another half hour. Maybe give us a few lines. What would be your best piece of advice for the new president, our new president, how he should approach his work with Putin?
Well, you and I were talking, about this at lunch, about how Ronald Reagan, really approached trying to, get to know Gorbachev and vice versa. I said it was probably quite a lot easier to do that with Gorbachev than, it will be in this case. But also based on being very firm and very strong about what you wanted and what you might be prepared to talk about, having some leverage. Reagan had an awful lot of leverage in the meetings with Gorbachev because of Star Wars, missile defense, and also the arms race that we'd been engaged in, which was becoming ruinous for the Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union was being brought down in part by that, but many other contradictions. There was also, the real fear that this confrontation was going to get out of hand. And I think we are actually, to be honest, in a very similar situation. This could very much get out of hand. We're in a war avoidance mode, I think, at this moment, which actually might help to clarify the situation. But it's very clear what the Russians want. And I mean, I won't go into all this because it will take an awfully long time. But they've made their views, their desires, their wishes for this relationship very clear. They want respect and to be treated as an equal with the United States, which is up at the top of this. They have some very practical issues of wanting the sanctions removed. So they have an awful lot of angst, of asks from us. They've got a lot of angst about how we're going to be treating them. So the very first measure for a first meeting would be to make it as cordial and mutually respectful as possible. No trash talking of each other, no demonization of the other. I mean, this has always been a problem that we're related to, but we have to be very careful about this, because Putin is actually somebody who also takes an insult very seriously. And it's very interesting to watch how he's been reacting to the expulsion of the 35 diplomats. He hasn't responded. He's watching and trying to wait now to see how the president-elect is going to talk about him, how the president-elect is going to approach this issue, and what the president-elect is likely to be able to deliver. Because we have to make sure that whatever we go into that room within our minds, and this will be only the first of many meetings, because it will take an awful long time to resolve anything, that we never talk about anything that we can't deliver. And I think that was also a lesson from the Reagan period. I mean, if there was an issue that you couldn't deliver on, you wouldn't make an undertaking about it. We have made so many promises to the Russians over various resets of the relationship from Clinton through George W. Bush through Obama, and I've seen a lot of these close up and in first hand, where we couldn't deliver what we were undertaking. There's an example that I can give you under George W. Bush, because it's been out there now in public, where Secretary Gates and Secretary Rice went off to Moscow to have a serious talk about missile defense. And there was an agreement that had already been worked out in advance And when they were on the plane on the way back, other parts of the interagency walked that agreement back. The Russians were absolutely furious, and Putin decided he wasn't going to deal with George W. Bush again. I mean, on this. He was a nice man, and Putin thought, but he couldn't deliver anything. He couldn't even deliver anything from his own administration. So it'll be very important for the president-elect to create a really coherent team, not one that's fighting over what might be ultimately points of negotiation with Russia that they're trying to walk back, because that will be then the beginning of just the same sort of cycle of recrimination that we had before. The Reagan era tells us that you can make a deal if you're very clear about what it is you're going to be talking about and starting off with. I mean, arms control was a big thing, but it was also very well defined. And we were very clear about how far we were going to go, although there is, of course, the talk that Reagan at one point thought, how about I just, you know, that Reykjavik, let's just get rid of everything. You know, that was obviously not feasible. So we have to be very careful about choosing, and the president will have to be very careful about choosing what topic we first try to make some progress on to make sure that we can deliver anything that we undertake.
We're out of time here.
Sorry.
Just one final question, and that is, if any one of us were to sit down at a dinner party with Vladimir Putin, would we find him to be charming?
No, we would not. Depending on who we are, actually, you know. So let's be true. If he's sitting with the president-elect and family members of the president-elect, and you know, senior people that he has to be charming to, he will be utterly charming. If one of us is randomly sat next to him, he will not be desperately charming unless he actually has to be. So I've been randomly sat next to Putin twice at a dinner. He is incredibly self-contained. He makes sure not to have eye contact. The disturbing thing of having a dinner with him is he doesn't eat or drink anything, which makes you want to not eat or drink yourself, because you think, what does he know about the food that you don't know? He does not make small talk, and he's just not personally charismatic. He doesn't exude anything. I mean, all of us know somebody who sit next to and you think, wow, look at this. I mean, this is incredible. Look at this person. What a personality. That's not Putin. He's not bursting out all over there with personality. And so everything that you see about him being or seeming charismatic on television and with the people is all very carefully orchestrated. Putin can play any kind of role in any kind of circumstance as an extraordinarily well-trained KGB officer can, or as any politician can be. He will make people think that the most important person he's talking to when he needs to, when he has to. And I've heard stories he's very charming and very friendly with his friends. But with somebody who is just really not very, you know, important in the picture there, or is not going to be instrumental in moving something forward, he is strikingly uncharismatic and not charming. And he's not in person, you know, particularly, impressive person, but he rises to every occasion. And he's one person who can pull off pretending to be a firefighter. He's a real judo player. He's taught himself how to play ice hockey. You know, but he never looks ridiculous doing any of these positions. You notice now he's not taking his shirt off anymore. So he's kind of, you know, he knows when to stop doing things and when to start moving on into a different role. So, I mean, you know, he should never be underestimated.
Well, thank you so much, Fiona. It's
thank
wonderful.
You. No problem. Appreciate it.